Okay, this is part three of our talk with Ike Willis. This is December 16th, 2011, and this is copyright New Grandview Incorporated, all rights reserved, and we're starting at 7:43 p.m. Hawaii time. Greetings, Ike.
Howdy, Uncle Bob.
Okay, there was a couple of loose ends from our last session yesterday, and I forgot to ask you, what was the skill, talent of Terry Bozzio?
Terry, I think, was Frank's first truly technical drummer, right? Are you there?
I'm there, yep.
Okay, Frank, he came in on the Bongo Fury tour, and as far as I'm concerned, he was Frank's first truly predominantly technical drummer. Okay, I mean, because Chester was great, Ralph was great, but they were more, I'd say, more groove oriented than the other drummers until then, right?
Groove until, group or you know, groove?
Groove.
Groove, G-R-O-V-E.
Yes, more groove oriented.
So to be a technical drummer, that is someone who is more trained in something?
Well, let me put it this way. They were more, yes, trained and more about the, like the chops and the technical skills. Like you know the guys that went to Berkeley and all.
Yeah.
And the, you know, because after, let's put it this way. After once the 70s and 80s rolled around, right?
Right.
You've got basically like the, no. Let me put it this way. Remember the Mahavishnu Orchestra?
Yep, John McLaughlin,
okay.
Yes.
John McLaughlin and those guys. Now, remember, until the Mahavishnu Orchestra, drummers weren't for most drummers and most musicians didn't pay that much attention to the technical aspects of playing. In other words, it was like you know the beat, blah blah blah. But after McLaughlin and those guys. You know, and especially like Eddie Van Halen and all those other guys, everybody all of a sudden was very, very technical and very, very what we call, you know, chops, you know, just tons and tons of chops.
Does that mean playing complicated rhythms?
Yeah. In other words, the sight readers, you know, the sight
yeah.
readers and stuff started popping out of the woodwork, right?
Right.
All the sight reading guys and stuff like that. Being super super technical, right?
Yeah.
It started coming about in the mid 70s, especially after McLaughlin and Return to Forever, you know those guys.
Tony Williams.
Oh God, yeah, Tony Williams, amazing, right?
Right.
And so once these guys started popping up, all of a sudden everybody wanted to be extremely technical, right? And Terry was one of the, even though Chester and Ralph can read their brains out. I mean, they can read anything, you know, and because, you know, they're the guys that could hold up all those complicated songs like Inca Roads and stuff like that. Okay,
yeah.
No problem. No problem. So what happened was Terry, as of the Bon Curie tour, Terry was the guy who, remember he did Black Page number one?
Yeah,
right?
Yep.
Right. Okay. That's what Terry was famous for.
Yes.
That's what Terry was famous for. He was doing Black Page number one, et cetera, which is a totally reading piece.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Terry, though, all told with that, Terry not only was a great technical reading drummer, sight reading drummer, but he was a technician. But also. Terry could groove his brains out too. I mean, Terry was he's a great groove meister. Not as good as Vinny, in my opinion.
Right.
But I mean, because Vinny, everybody considered Vinny super super technical. He was known as the kid who plays all the difficult Zappa shit, blah blah blah. But Vinny, they always said about Vinny, all the cats and all the session guys, their knock on him was, well, but he can't really groove. Like he can play his technical stuff, which was never true.
Mm.
Okay, and Terry, like I said, in my opinion, he was Frank's first, not purely technical drummer, but was more used with technical stuff and technique than Chester and Ralph, you know, stuff like
Right. And Frank.
Yeah, but Terry was incredibly talented. He can groove. He can go technical. He can do jazz. He can do all forms of music, every genre, which is very great for him.
Yeah, he's like the next generation who can do everything.
That's what I'm saying. He was the new generation.
Who can stand on the shoulders of the previous generations and cop their styles plus other stuff.
Oh yeah, indeed. Yeah. And cop their styles, and also you know, play the stuff that Chester and Ralph could do.
Yeah, an instant factor that comes to my mind is, as you get the affluent American life of the 50s and 60s, you got baby boomer kids and youngers having the time, sitting around their bedrooms, to learn all this stuff, whereas Ralph and the other guys, Chester's generation and earlier, man, they probably didn't have as much leisure time to really work out their stuff.
They were too busy learning, you know, coming up on Philly Joe Jones and Tony Williams and you know, Ralph and God, who am I thinking about?
Say Coltrane.
The Coltrane stuff, Bernard Purdy, everybody, Miles, and everybody like that.
They would do that. You know, you didn't get a record. Look at Zappa. It didn't have any record player or a record or anything when he's 15 or 16. You know, Bozio, he's 10 years old. It's a little more affluent the next generation. They got records when they're 10 years old. You know what I mean? They can start earlier.
Sure. Of course, but that's because that's how we grew up. We're the sons and daughters of the baby boomers.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, their whole thing was making life better than they had it, you know, after World War II, blah blah blah, all that stuff.
Right.
So that was very, very important to our parents and big brothers and sisters and et cetera, et cetera. Very, very important. And so we had the time to sit around and listen to McLaughlin and Return to Forever and all those guys because, I mean, that in Tony Williams' Lifetime. Remember Lifetime?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Holdsworth and all those guys and Alan Pasqua. Those guys were incredible. And from that generation, it was like me and Holly and all of our friends, we were the guys who cut our teeth on those guys.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And all those other guys. I used to practice in my dorm room. I used to put my speaker cabinet up in my window after school. And practiced on Yes and Return to Forever and all those guys, you know, after school.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh my God, incredible.
Okay, so Terry, Frank wants to present more complex stuff. So Terry shows up to fulfill the later 70s desires of Frank.
Well, it wasn't so much that Frank wanted to present more complex stuff. It's just that what he always used to tell me was that he didn't have. Until Chester and Ralph and Terry came along, he didn't have the guys. He didn't have the guys that could pull off this stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, like Jimmy Carl Black wasn't. Jimmy was okay. He was okay as a drummer, but he could not pull off.
He couldn't read, could he?
No. Jimmy couldn't read. No.
Yeah.
No.
So. Okay, so we see now Terry Bozzio's gone on to become really famous, right? And he puts
on
seminars. And
is
he one of the considered one of the best drummers in the world now? If they still make those?
Oh yeah! Drums? Oh, definitely.
Right.
Definitely so. Yes, he's considered one of the top two or three drummers in the world, or whatever. You know. Like,
right.
It's like Vinny, Terry, Chad, you know, stuff like that.
Okay, so that's Terry. He's kind of obvious, his abilities. What about Scott Tunis? We didn't talk about him.
Well, Scott, what do you want to know about Scott?
What's his talent? What's his main talent that is useful to Frank?
Well, Scott was an incredible. Well, let me tell you this about Scott. Scott Tunis. Here's the book on Scott. Scott, wildly, incredibly, supremely talented. I mean, Not only is he a great bass player, he's a great sight reader. He's a great he was, and actually during the last rehearsals for the last tour, Scott was in 88 that tour's clone meister.
Right.
Yeah, it was his turn. And Scott, incredibly talented, amazingly, amazingly talented.
Could he play other instruments?
Oh, yeah. He could play guitar, he could play keyboards, all that stuff.
Oh, okay.
Very, very good. Yeah.
So he's like Bobby Martin.
Not on Bobby's level. I mean, Bobby
could play the horn.
But Scott didn't like horns. Okay.
Right.
Scott didn't like horns and horn players. That was one of his gripes. But
yeah, what would he have against horn players? What's his problem? Was there an idiosyncratic reason?
No. Here's what I was saying about Scott. Okay, look. Don't make too much out of this.
Right.
This is just my opinion.
Yeah.
My read on Scott, since I met him, incredibly, supremely talented. Right.
Right.
Amazingly talented, in all the things that he does. And actually, you remember the group Dead Kennedys?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's what Scott. No. The Young Republicans. I'm sorry. Young Republicans, who came along at the same time, right after Dead Kennedy.
Yes.
Well, Scott came to us after he went from Young Republicans to us.
Hmm. Okay.
And you know, he knows like the Residents and all those other guys.
Yeah.
That's who he came up on. So he's more of like a punk, like a new wave punk.
Yeah.
Kind of upbringing. Right?
Yeah.
And
I get
Scott,
that.
But the thing is, here's the difference. Whereas the guys and the new wave guys were just bare bones. Back to the basics.
Minimalist.
totally minimalist, right?
Yeah.
Fear, and all those other things. Well, Scott, to make it different, Scott learned how to read music. He went to a music school and all that stuff.
Right. And he could play guitar. That might have been his main instrument when he began, just guitar in general.
Well actually, I don't know. I mean, I never asked him. But here's the thing. But Scott, you know, he learned piano. He knows all the classical stuff. He learned how to read.
Well, that's like Tommy Mars. That's like Tommy Mars.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. But he's such a minimalist and to rebel. You know, he was such a rebel about all of that stuff.
Yeah.
He, being of the punk and new wave kind of thing, he kind of turned his nose up at those kind of guys, right?
You mean the classical and the
the conservatory trained
right.
The Berkeley guys and stuff like that. He sort of looked down his nose at those guys.
Oh, so that might be partly why he doesn't like the horn guys or the jazz guys.
Exactly. You see what I'm saying?
Because so what is he liking then? What's he want?
He never told anybody. Here's the thing about Scott. Like I said, in conclusion, wildly, incredibly, supremely talented.
Yeah.
But incredibly, incredibly spoiled. I mean, just spoiled rotten. Because he grew up, you know, pretty privileged and stuff like that. But man, let me tell you something. Just very, 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 very small. Very spoiled. Throwing temper tantrums, and you know, when he didn't get his way, and just erupting. Throwing temper tantrums and stuff like that. When he didn't get his way, and when things didn't go the way that. Or if it was something that he didn't like, Scott was very. Let me put it this way. He was very, very, very. One of his habits was, which always drove people crazy, which led to a lot of the problems was that he would just outburst. He would say whatever was on his mind.
He's a mild Tourette.
Yeah, exactly. What the thing is, and not so bloody mild either. not so mild. Scott would just, whatever he had in his mind, he would just blurt out in front of anybody whatever was in his mind. Okay, if he didn't like something or if he was pissed off about something or whatever, he would just say it. Okay.
Right.
And it didn't matter where the hell we were. It didn't matter where we were. It didn't matter. Okay. It didn't matter where we were. He would just give his opinion on anything and anybody, you know, no matter who was there, no matter who was around, etc. Okay.
Okay. Did he come from an upper middle class home?
I'm thinking yes.
So he's
from what I know about him and his family, yes.
And so he has a chip on his shoulder. About what? Besides the old any tradition?
Well, see, that's the thing. Scott sort of made his thing about being.
He's a prima donna, is what you're saying. He's a diva.
Well, yeah. Not as bad as Napoleon.
Right.
Not as bad as Napoleon, but a prima donna nonetheless.
Napoleon who? You say
precisely.
You say Napoleon? Okay.
Precisely.
Yeah, all right. I've talked to Napoleon. I think I see what you
right,
mean.
Of course.
Yeah. So he had this prima donna. He was talented, so he was spoiled as a great genius and his opinion ruled, and he even was so good, he became Klonmeister. I mean, you got to know a lot to do that, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. When you stick around long enough in Frank's band, you know, let me put it this way. If I had gone on, done the 81 and 82 tours.
Right, yeah.
And then it would have been my turn to be Klonmeister because I had the seniority.
Right.
Right, because it would have been my turn, and it just so happened that I ended up being Klonmeister anyway. You know, after the big blow up and stuff.
Right, right, yeah.
Yeah, which was my thing anyway, because I learned how to conduct and things like that, and so I ended up after Scott's big blow up, I ended up conducting the band while Scott was in charge of the charts.
Right, because you couldn't read.
Anyway.
You couldn't read. Could you read?
Well, no. I can read, but I'm not a sight reader to the extent that the Fowlers and Penny and all those guys
are.
Yeah, okay?
Right.
I'm slow
right.
at it, okay? And I'm plotting because I know the basic terminology. I know the basic stuff. But I'm not a sight reader to that extent like the rest of my brothers are. I mean, because those guys are fantastic. Right.
Right, but Scott, he was a sight reader, so he had the charts, whereas you were the Klonmeister. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is, with me, that's the thing. I mean, because of my lack of formal training, Frank has to have. I mean, we have to have somebody that sight reads in order to ride herd on the sight readers in the band, you know, the horn players, the keyboard players, and stuff like that, with the more complicated pieces, you know, when we're rehearsing the seriously complicated pieces and stuff, there's got to be a serious reader, in order to hold down that particular gig. Okay,
I got that. Now here's something that just occurred to me. He only was there for the 84 tour, but do you have any comments on Alan Zavod?
Zavod.
Z-A-V-O-D.
Yeah, Zavod.
Piano player.
Oh, no. Zavod, another genius, another great keyboard player, another great musician. Incredible, because he started out with Jean-Luc Ponty.
Ah.
I've known him since. He was in Ponty's band. But he's from Australia. And he's a classically trained guy. He's, you know, he's been around for a long time. And in Australia, he was very, very popular, very well known, very famous, et cetera, And at the 84, we had Zavod and Bobby on keyboards.
Yes.
But Alan has a bit of the prima donna in him too.
Right.
But he's a great guy. He's a fantastic guy. You know, he's a funny guy, and you know. Wildly talented and stuff like that, but he's more interested in, let's say, showing off or you know.
Yeah, he didn't want to share the keyboard role. He wanted to be the only one, maybe. Right.
Exactly. And Frank, I used to get on him sometimes about going overboard. You know, Frank used to call it his explosions, because when he'd have his solo time,
yeah,
he would like just really go overboard and stuff like that. And
yeah,
he's looking at the chicks and stuff like that, and sometimes he would miss cues.
Yeah,
and frankly, and there's a couple of times in a couple of the albums. I think one of them is on "You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore." One of the volumes where we're starting out. I can't remember the tune we were beginning, but Zavod missed the intro to one of the tunes, and Frank stops the tune after they're like the second measure.
Yeah.
And says, "Alan Zavod, that was inexcusable. Do it again. You know better." Yeah, it's on one of the albums.
Yeah.
On one of the albums.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
So, that's how Alan was, but incredible keyboard player. I mean, incredible talent. Amazing.
Okay, so before we go into Zappa's guitar playing, I'm just thinking,
right.
did Frank talk or gossip to you about Mick Jagger, all the guys in the Yes and the Queen bands in the 70s? Did he talk about those other mainstream successes at any time? Was he interested
in that? Well, he wasn't interested in it. I mean, he was more into doing his own thing and stuff like that. And his opinion, because he knew Jagger and Clapton and Hendrix and all those other guys, but his thing was the only people that he really respected was John Lennon. They were good friends.
Yeah.
When they were living in New York.
Yeah.
John Lennon and a couple of other guys. Mike Nesmith from the Monkees.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Mike Nesmith from the Monkees. But and also the main guy that he really loved, and I never heard. Oh, he really loved and he really raved about and had ultimate respect for was Hendrix.
Ah.
Oh yeah, was Hendrix. I mean, when I joined the band, he made me. My orders were, he broke out these guitars that Hendrix used to use, that Hendrix used to borrow while Frank was when they used to jam together.
Yeah.
And Frank has one of the burned ones, and
he has
one of the right. Okay.
Yes.
He gave me that one, and a Fender Jaguar, and a Gibson L5 Switchmaster.
He gave them for you to use during rehearsals?
Yeah. No, on stage.
Okay.
He says, okay, I want you to use, as long as you're in this band, I want you to use these guitars, because these are the ones that Hendrix used to use when we used to jam together.
Right.
And he used to just rave. That Hendrix was the only guy that I ever seen Frank, actually, his eyes would glaze over, and he just would just rave over.
That's interesting, because in 68, when he writes the Life magazine article and maybe a couple other interviews in that, it was striking that he would praise Hendrix. I never really saw him, heard him at that point praising anybody, but he had respect for Hendrix. It comes out in that period. And then, but we know that Frank was an amazing guitar, and this is perfect to go from here into Frank's guitar playing, from Hendrix to Frank, because you'll hear some good stuff on Absolutely Free. I don't know if you hear much in We're Up for the Money, but it's not till Hot Rats in 69-70 that you hear
right.
Frank laying it out, you know, what he could do. And
Yeah, so... Just amazing stuff. Incredible stuff. He was like every year, okay, Rolling Stone comes out with the top, you know, 100 guitar players and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's insane, because Frank would either never be listed, right? He would either never be listed or anything like that. And Frank, or just totally ignored. And Frank was, which was insane. Frank was one of the most amazing guitar players on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, man, he was astoundingly good. I mean, and the thing is, all of the other big time, big name guys, all the other big name guys were big fans of Frank's guitar playing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, huge. Frank was amazing.
He was
amazing.
A guitar player. And,
exactly.
But I can see, you know, the Rolling Stone staff, whatever, they're irritated in 68, 69 by Frank's not totally doing the party line about the hippies and the counterculture and all that.
Exactly.
And he's
exactly.
putting out albums satirizing him. You don't know the now. If you attend his concerts and the bootlegs of that period, you can hear it. But it's interesting how he kind of held himself back, and yet.
I don't think he held himself back. The thing was that they didn't like about Frank was that he not only did he had criticisms of the so-called counterculture lifestyle and the hippie guys and the popular guys. You know, remember Clapton is God, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Jeff Beck.
But Jeff Beck and all those guys who got all the attention.
Yes.
Right? But Frank didn't hang out, okay? He wasn't the guy who he didn't hang out with all the popular guys.
That's right.
Right? He always did his own thing. He didn't hang out with the popular guys. He wasn't out there trying to be seen and trying to be popular and all that other stuff.
Yeah, which is part of the popularity for the journalists. You got to hang out with the journalists.
You got to hang out with the popular God guys. Okay.
Okay. So
he was never about that.
Right. So this here he is. He's praising Hendrix in 68. Frank can play. He apparently invented the fuzz pedal, fuzz technology in 66, 67.
Distortion. Yes.
Yeah. Now he could play. He could do Hendrix before Hendrix. Can you say that?
Well, as far as sustained notes and distortion and stuff like that. Yes. I mean, actually, well, Hendrix was doing it before Frank was, but that was back when he was with King Curtis and the Isley Brothers and stuff like that. And they thought the same thing about Frank, that he's just insane. They
right.
just thought he was crazy, okay? and that's why they got along so well. Hendrix did his own thing. It's like, have you ever heard the story when Hendrix got out of the army and moved to England because, of course, everybody thought he was insane.
Yeah.
And he put together the experience, and Mick Jagger runs into Eric Clapton's place and starts raving about it. He says, hey, man, there's this black guy that's from America who's stealing our stuff. Okay? That was the book on Hendrix.
Right, right, right.
You know, stealing our stuff, and of course you know where that comes from, because Clapton and all those guys, they all stole from Muddy Waters and B.B.
Yeah.
King and all that other stuff, right?
So this was the first. Hendrix was the first to counter the British invasion, do what the British invasion did.
Oh, precisely. Yes. He was the first to counter the British invasion.
Which is interesting. In Time magazine, December 69, Beefheart is interviewed for Troutmaster Replica, and he says the song Beetle Bones and Smokin' Stones was a satire on them. It's like Don and Frank represent let's take this stuff back, you know, let's push back the British invasion. That's their kind of mentality, and then so Frank would like Hendrix for being like that, to get that accusation.
Exactly. Oh, no, loving it. That was like the best thing on earth, because, which is why also Frank and Jimmy got along so well. And then the thing is, whatever Frank was doing, it was still like whatever Hendrix was doing was just way over the top. Remember, this was the 60s, okay? And remember, Hendrix didn't hit the scene or become the world famous Jimi Hendrix until 67. That's when his professional, you know, worldwide career, you know, jumped off. Right?
Yeah.
So this is 67, and Franklin and Jimmy were playing together in 65, 66.
Oh, I didn't know that he knew him earlier before.
Oh yeah, but this is what I'm saying. When Frank and the Mothers were based in New York.
Yeah, that's 66, 67.
Right, working out of the Garrick, the old Garrick Theater.
Right. That's 67. Right. You're not talking 65, 66, and that's when Hendrix goes to London, I think, in 66, walks on stage and hijacks the whole show. That's how
exactly.
he Right. That's exactly. The same period as either before Frank. Garrick Theater is the summer of 67. He had played in New York in 66. So,
right. Well, that's what I'm saying, because Hendrix was in New York, that's when Frank was there as well.
Right. Okay. That's when they met and jammed in New York.
Yes.
And whenever
Jimmy came back to New York.
Right. So
Jimmy came back to New York.
So would Jimmy have sat in on the Garrick Theater shows?
Could be. I mean, there's an old show where at the Garrick, but Hendrix and Frank and John Lennon jammed together, and I think there's an old video of it as well.
Well, he doesn't meet John Lennon until June 71, where they close the Fillmore. And that's
No. I got a little news for you.
Okay.
They actually met before then.
Okay, that's not known, because Dave Wally brought them together in June 71, and Yoko was there.
On stage. But I'm talking about back in the Beatles days. Apparently, what Frank told me was that is when he met Lennon. Okay.
That's interesting. You mean after?
He used to sneak off, and hang out with Frank and all that stuff.
Well, that's interesting.
Sure.
Because the Frank used to talk about the picture of Paul McCartney conducting the band while they were making the orchestra, or whatever, while they were making Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in early '67.
Oh, yeah.
Based on a picture, Frank said, of Frank conducting the Lumpy Gravy recording in February 67. So there's Paul aware of Frank, says. But maybe he could back that up by saying, well, John turned Paul on to Zappa, because John had met
That could very well be. And that does make sense.
Okay.
That does make sense. Because, I mean, the Beatles, they got around. They snuck, you know, they'd sneak off. They'd sneak off and hang out with people that they dug too. Remember, because there's those stories about them hooking up with Elvis at one point in time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
You know the famous statement, and this is a statement. You know, for the generations now, the Beatles are archetypes, and they just know about John Lennon and all that he did, and he's a big icon. But what would they think of the statement that John Lennon makes in his long interview with what's the main guy of Rolling Stone? Jonathan Winter? I forget his name. You know, the Rolling Stone magazine, the founder of Rolling Stone. Forget his name.
Oh, Jan Winter.
Yeah, Jan Winter.
Jan Winter, yes.
He does a long interview of John Lennon in 70, 71, and it comes out as a book, a small book. But in there, John Lennon says, I would rather have been Frank Zappa.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He says it right in the middle of the interview. He says,
wow. Well,
yeah.
That makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense, because Frank and John were actually, what he told me when we started doing the Beatles medley and stuff in
1988. Yeah.
He said, well, look, you know, I really wasn't all that big on the Beatles and stuff. I mean, I liked some of their stuff. He wasn't that big. He wasn't that much into Paul.
Right.
He says, but John, he loves John's stuff. He loved John's stuff. And you'll notice that the songs we're doing on the Beatles medley, they're all John's compositions.
Okay. All right.
Walrus, Strawberry Fields, Lucy in the Sky, right?
Yeah.
Norwegian Wood.
Yes.
Those are the.
Yeah.
You got to remember, on all the Beatles, the Lennon McCartney songs compositions, right?
Yeah.
It was Mac Lennon music, and it was all of their. They both got the credit for it, right?
Yeah.
But there are some songs that obviously Paul wrote, okay? And
yeah.
There's some songs that obviously John wrote, you know?
Right.
And the songs that we were doing were the ones that Frank, he said, you know, I mean, Paul's okay, but I was never really into him that much. I like John's songs.
Right.
And that's why he was asking, well, does anybody know I'm the Walrus? Does anybody know Norwegian Wood? Does anybody know Lucy in the Sky, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay, here's another story. Frank says in some interview, maybe in the mid-'80s, they ask him about Gail, and he says, Gail is no Linda McCartney. He blatantly puts down Paul's wife.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. It was like the Linda McCartney, Yoko thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. No, Gail, that's one thing. Gail and I have our issues, but Frank was exactly right about that. She is no Linda McCartney, okay? she's not into hanging out with him or just being wanting to be a part of the band, you know, just to be there.
Right, right.
You see that thing? And demanding to be made a part of the band, blah, blah, blah.
Here's an interesting anecdote to put on the record. David Wally gave me the letter that Zappa wrote John and Yoko after they met in June 71 to do that last Fillmore East concert, and Yoko does her bag thing. You can see that on YouTube. Well, the letter is there was a proposed installation piece they were going to do in some New York art gallery, and they wanted Frank to be part of it. So he writes a letter to John and Yoko saying, you need to find the hood, I think it is, some car part of a 39 Chevy. And he gives these elaborate instructions for them to go find this particular hood, and that is what he wants to contribute to the installation. It was almost a brush-off letter, like it's an absurd search for this one object, which would be very hard to find, I think. And I think that was there was a problem there. Frank did not really want to work with them, maybe because of Yoko. But I may be misinterpreting the letter, but that's how Dave Wally and I interpreted it. It was very abstract and rude or strange. It was almost like Frank says, okay, if you want me to work with you, you're going to have some of my conceptual continuity in the installation, you know? So we're going to have to bring in Studebaker Hawk's car or something like that.
Precisely. Okay, I get it.
But
I never heard about that part. But yeah, that makes sense.
Do you think now, Ben Watson's come up with a theory that, oh no, that song, Oh No, which is made in early 69 or so, where it seems he's putting down the student leaders, the Abby Hoffmans, the SDS, saying all you need is love and those kind of things.
Yeah.
Ben Watson thinks it's a reference to Yoko Ono. And that it's a reference to the spring of 69 when they were doing the Bed In for Peace and were getting married and going around.
Right.
And it's hard to determine, like Ben and I checked out what we could find out. It's hard to determine when the song was written and who it would be played off of. But it was a pretty interesting theory that actually it was a pun on and targeted at John Yoko as peaceniks, because he's saying, you think the world is love. Interesting.
Now, that could very well be. That makes a ton of sense. I never asked him what the song was based on.
Yeah, which student rebels or love-in guys gurus.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it would be incredible if it was a pun on Yoko Ono. Oh no.
Exactly. Wow. That is very interesting. That makes a ton of sense now that you put it that way.
Yeah.
When you bring it up in that context, that makes a ton of sense.
Right. So a scholar of Zappa or whoever could find the records is to find out when he wrote that song. If he played it in late 68, that's before the Bed in Peace, which is the spring of 69. But if he wrote it in 69, like in May or April, then it could be Yoko Ono and John's peace thing.
Now it very well could be. That makes a hell of a lot of sense. Wow. When I put that together with what I know in my experience with Frank, that makes a ton of sense. Oh my God. Wow. That's pretty damn interesting. That's pretty flippin' interesting.
All right. Well, I'll pass that on to Ben. Maybe he has some more stuff.
Yeah, because if anybody would know, it would be Ben or somebody.
No, it's not Ben. No, Ben, he can't find it. He thought I could find stuff.
We can't
find someone who knows what was going on in late 68 and early 69, and when did he write that song?
Right.
That's the timing. We're trying to find the timing. Now, maybe Ian Underwood or Don Preston might know, whoever's in the band in 68, 69.
That's true. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, now back to Frank's guitar playing. When I heard Frank play in the late 60s, I said, well, nobody's as good as this. How come there's no talk about it? And there wasn't any. And
right.
What is it about Frank did not rehearse. I mean, he did not practice, you know what I mean, the guitar. But he would do it a lot when he was rehearsing, and the rehearsals would go on for months in the later years. So that was like his practicing. But what is it about Frank's ability? He didn't even play normally. Like his hands were different, or he did a different way of strumming or something. Do you know what I mean? I remember reading about this.
Well, here's the thing. Frank had double-jointed fingers, first of all.
Really?
Yes, he had double-jointed fingers. And also, you saw the way that he strummed the guitar.
Yeah.
Right? He held his pick with three fingers. Where he held his pick with three fingers.
Right.
But he also, the way he phrased chords and things like that, his fingers were double-jointed.
Wow.
His fingers were double-jointed. I mean, I noticed that right off the bat. And I asked him about that. He said, well, you know, that's just the way I play. You know, but his fingers were double-jointed.
Now, what would that mean? Explain for the listener.
Well, you know,
what
I
does
mean,
double-jointed do with your playing?
Double-jointed, if somebody's double-jointed, that means that their fingers or legs or whatever can bend
backwards.
Bend backwards or you know, and other in other ways, right?
Right.
And Frank's fingers could do that. You know, his fingers could do that. And the way he formed chords and things like that, the way he formed chords and stuff like that was basically that's it made his hands look funny. While he was making chords and things like that.
You know what comes to mind? In Bruce Bickford's Baby Snakes animation, when he has Frank or whoever playing the guitar, his hands are mutating and flipping and double jointing all over the guitar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, that was a.
He knew.
That was an exaggeration of what Frank's fingers really look like. I mean,
wow.
Bickford basically took. Basically took what Frank had to offer, and he was just mimicking Frank.
Right, right.
Yeah,
oh.
He was just mimicking Frank essentially. That's what that was.
Okay, so Frank, you would agree that Frank created a playing that was totally eccentric and unique to him.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yes, I agree.
So why didn't he have to practice?
Well, it's not that he didn't have to practice. That's just how he was. I mean, he hated practicing. Really, he hated it. There'd be times when he wouldn't even pick up the guitar. He wouldn't even pick up the guitar until rehearsals started for the next tour.
Right.
You know. Yeah. I mean, a couple of years would go by.
That's right.
Right, a couple of years would go by, and he would not pick up the guitar at all.
That's what I mean, and he had to work in his calluses again.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That's just how he was. I mean, he would just not pick up the guitar at all. You know, for a couple of years.
Because he's too busy inventing things and being a scientist, not just a musician.
Precisely.
He's got other things to do.
Precisely. I mean, that's just how he was. He wouldn't pick up his guitar for a couple of years, and until it was time to rehearse for the tour.
Yeah.
You know, I mean that's just how he was.
Did you ever talk much to Cal Schenkel?
I ran into Cal when I was down in Florida, playing a couple of concerts with Bogus Pomp.
Right.
And we did this thing. We did an orchestra thing, in Tampa. And with the Tampa Symphony Orchestra,
right?
And Cal got invited down there by Bogus Pomp's manager at the time, who was an old friend of mine, Steve. And they rented him like a beach house on the bay and stuff like that. And Cal was one of the guests. And that's when I got a chance to talk to him.
Did you ever talk about conceptual continuity imagery or the stuff on the Uncle Meat booklet? Did you get into any of that, his own artwork and what Frank told him to do?
No, we just hung out.
Okay. So here you play your guitar and you're watching Frank and you got to play off Frank. Was there anything difficult about it?
Well, not for me, because I mean I had my own instructions pretty much. I basically just followed Frank's lead. In other words, Frank would give me my instructions. He would give me my instructions, and then I would follow my instructions. You know, whatever he wanted me to play at the time, and you know, I would basically do my job.
Right, and Frank would be doing something different. So it wasn't that you had
sure.
to be in harmony with him or whatever you call it when you're a musician.
Well, that depended all on what he wanted. You know,
yeah.
That would depend on what my instructions were at the time.
Okay, so maybe Frank didn't have to rehearse in the interim years between tours, and then was able to play because he already had so many ideas and a repertoire of riffs and stuff that was enough for anybody. You know what I mean?
And also keep in mind that even if he didn't have anything in the repertoire of whatever,
yeah.
Even if he didn't, he would come in and say, okay, tell me to grab my guitar and essentially just start playing a groove or playing an idea musically that he had in his head at that particular time, right? And then I would start the part that he would tell me to play. And then he'd go to the other musicians and tell them and then have them give them parts as well. And then we just essentially start working on those parts until they made sense to him. You know, something like that.
Right, and that he then would invent stuff of himself in response to that. So he would
exactly.
see. Yeah.
It was like a call and response thing.
Right, right, and
right.
and you would never know how he'd respond.
Oh God, no.
Right.
No, never know how he'd respond. I mean, it would be all fresh and brand new at the time.
Right. Now I remember him saying sometime in the late 70s, early 80s. They might have been talking about Joe's Garage or something. He forced himself to go on a vacation, and he was in a hotel for a couple of weeks. And the music just keeps pouring through his brain, you know, and he has
right.
to write down. I call it kind of a conscious mediumship. If you have a channel, a trance medium, who has all this stuff come in and he's not even aware of it, it's like Frank, as an artist, is a conscious medium. There's constantly musical ideas and patterns, just he can't stop it happening in his mind.
Exactly. No doubt about that. I mean, it was always in the process of happening, okay? He was just always thinking of new things. You know, he'd come up with another idea. And he had guys like us around to flesh him out.
Right.
You know, because with me, a lot of times, and Denise will back me up on this, I'd get a call at 2-3 in the morning. You know, I'd get a call at 2 or 3 in the morning from Frank, and it would be, well, Ike, are you busy? You know, or Ike, are you busy? And it's like, well, can you come up to the house? You know, and then I'd go up to the house, and he's working on something. Okay, he's working on whatever.
Yeah.
Or a mix or something like that he wanted me to hear, or an idea that he had, right? And that was the thing. You know, that was the thing. We would be working on, he would just have me working on stuff or doing stuff that just popped into his head.
So you might have just had 2 hours sleep. He'd wake you up, you'd get up there, and then you'd be all energized once you got there, even though you only had 2 hours sleep, or something like that?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Of course.
Okay, I'm thinking that he, in one of the first interviews in the New York Times about 1966, when he's probably just played in New York, but not at the Garrick Theater yet, he says, "We don't know who the drummer is in the group."
Mm-hmm.
We don't, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if it's an accurate quote, he's saying, you know, this guy plays this and that, but we don't know who really is the drummer. We don't know which musician or which instrument is the drum, which means it's rhythmic percussion mania, and he started off
right.
as a drummer as a kid. Do you think, was he thinking rhythms or thinking about drum scenarios when he had ideas? Did that ever come across?
Well, probably, because we got to remember his music is very, very percussive.
Yeah.
It's very percussive in nature.
He's actually the drumming composer. So he started off as a drummer.
Which is why for Frank, it was very important that he had a kind of drummer that could pull off what he wanted.
Right.
That was very important. That was hugely important.
Well, how about this? The playing off all the different musicians and instruments, all within a percussive framework, very complex signatures, would put, from his perspective, the drummer, the little drummer, was not the only drummer in the band. The guitarist, the saxophone.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. All the instruments were percussive.
Percussing.
Okay. That's why we had all those different grooves.
Yeah.
And time signatures. Plus the fact that you got to remember, people always ask me about Frank's time signatures and stuff like that, and how those were constructed. Basically, what ended up being my job was when Frank would write lyrics, for example.
Yeah.
And they would end up coming out. The lyrics would end up coming out not precisely in 4/4 or whatever, and because of how many words were in the how many words were in the phrase or anything like that, right?
Yeah.
And basically, and then he would tell me, we try to make the lyrics fit. And basically, my job was, it's like, well, okay, make them fit.
Right. He write the lyrics, then he give you these things sprawling all over the place, and you have to fit them in or make up rhythms or something to have them fit.
Well, basically, I would have to make the whatever lyrics that he had fit into the time that he wanted for that particular song.
So that part,
like outside now and stuff like that.
Right. So the odd singing to the normal ears was a result of you. This is your composing ability that you add to it. You had to figure out how to fit it, how to sing it.
Yeah, I had to figure out a way to make it work. which was fun for me, you know.
Yeah.
That was like fun. Okay, and I had no problem with that because it made sense to me.
Right. And so you would then work it out and then present, okay, and sing it and see what he thought of it.
Exactly. I'd sing it and then he'd either say, "Okay, that'll work," or "No, that won't work. Let's try it again." You know, like that.
Did Frank, when you're doing in the heat of this co-creation, was Frank ever irritable?
Sure.
You know, in a sense, like, well, okay, what is it, Ike? He's working on something. What is it, Ike? And then you do it, and he goes, "No, not good enough. Do it again," and move away, be brusque with you, and go address something else.
Well, that's the thing. I ended up learning over my first 2 years in the band when to actually bother him and when not to.
Right.
Okay. I just learned when was the right time to start talking to him or say something to him while he was in a certain mood or something like that. Because sometimes there'd be stuff at home or business or whatever that has him in a bad mood or whatever, right? So
you were monitoring that. You were monitoring his mood, so it was the right time to present it. So that you had to be careful.
I learned how to do that. Okay, I learned that.
Okay, I got that. So now, do you know astrology?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, so he's born on December 21st, Sagittarius and Capricorn cusp, right?
Right, exactly.
Do you know enough about those signs and what one would say, and does Frank fit that?
Actually, yeah, kind of, sort of. But, of course, they broke the mold when they made him. So.
Yes.
It was kind of, he was a Sagittarian, but he was a Capricorn, too. So that was I could see him being a combination. I can't remember what the
characteristics.
What the characteristics are of those two signs are. I think Sagittarius was the water bearer, or was that Capricorn?
I don't know. I don't know the stuff that
okay,
well.
Okay, but the thing was, the main thing was he was very much his own man. Okay, I mean,
you could say he's all signs. He's got aspects of all signs.
Yeah, I could see that. Yes. Yes.
Because here's an interesting point. You're in LA. Do you ever listen to KPFK?
Oh yeah, isn't that the KPFK? Isn't that the talk radio?
Well, no, it's the lefty station. I mean, they have a lot of talk
on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they have a guy on there from New York. He broadcasts WBAI named Gary Null. You've ever heard of him?
What's his name again?
Gary Null, N-U-L-L. He's an alternative health guru.
I think I might have caught him once or twice.
All right, so you don't really know him, but just for anybody who's listening, as I got to observe and know Gary a bit, he was born on January 6th, and he's right there as a Capricorn. I noticed that, and he's a driven person, and he actually is like Frank in his output and the way he's the negative image of Frank is this, you know, driving people, overworking, all that. Gary does that with his employees, and he has a lot of project going. So I wonder, I said, okay, he's a Capricorn. Frank's a
right.
Capricorn. Is there something about Capricorns that I'm seeing common to him and Gary? But
I don't know, because, I mean, I'm a Scorpion. Denise is a Scorpion, but we're both pretty driven as well.
Yeah.
I know people who are of other signs who are just as driven. Not to the extent of Frank, because Frank, I'll say this: people always ask me when in interviews and stuff that if I thought Frank was a slave driver, because the rumor was he works everybody hard and stuff like that. Oh God, he worked me to death, but I enjoyed it because I mean I thrive on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a creative environment. It's not slave driving.
Yeah. Totally creative environment, and I thrive on that kind of environment. In fact, I've said this before in various interviews and stuff, that Frank reminded me of the toughest when I played football in boarding school.
Yeah.
I had the coach that I had was the toughest coach that I ever had, and he drove me to pieces. He was harder on me. I was one of his favorites, but he was harder on me than just about anybody else there. And this guy grew up with Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
He grew up with Jesse Owens. He was one of the first black men to be accepted into medical school back in the 30s and 40s,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he drove my ass. He drove me like nobody's business.
Okay, so you're saying
he worked harder than anybody else.
Yeah, are you saying because you're used to him, Frank was a piece of cake?
No. Frank was like his equal, okay? Frank was very much they were like, in terms of what they did and how they worked me and how they drove me and encouraged me and et cetera, they were that's immediately who Frank reminded me of.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah, because Frank was a slave driver, but he was my slave driver.
Right, right. Okay, I this thought occurs to me. Are there people who got picked to be in the band that we don't know about that only lasted a few weeks because they couldn't take the hard work?
Exactly.
There are people that maybe auditioned.
Well, see, that's the thing. I've heard those rumors. I've heard those rumors. But I let's see. God, who am I thinking of?
Well, you don't have to name him, but I'm thinking that there weren't too many, that who Frank picked could take it. He seemed to know who could take it and didn't drop out. They didn't drop out, right?
Well, exactly. Because they're, you know, it's not, Frank used to tell me that being in his band and touring and all that stuff, it not everybody could do it. Okay?
Yeah.
Not everybody could do it. And if you could hang, if you could withstand the pressure and the touring, and then the relationships and the egos, et cetera, pretty much, it's not for everybody, and not everybody can do it. And you're showing something to him, and it basically confirms his confidence, his opinion, and lets him know that he made the right choice.
Right. Okay.
He told me that in the middle of my first tour.
That he made the right choice of picking you to be in the band.
Well, that's what he told me. He told me when I was having some difficulties with like racism and in America, not in Europe,
Right.
I had no problem in Europe, but I would get like offhand comments from like people in the audience who would ask me, "Well, you're in Frank's band? Oh, you must be the drummer or the bass player."
Right. Right.
Right. Or a couple of the guys in the crew, the road crew, I'd hear them like off to the side, you know, snickering and telling their little nigger jokes and things like that every now and then, because we had one guy who used to be our production manager, who was really bad at that, and it was starting to get on my nerves and it was starting to affect me, after a while.
Yeah.
And in the middle of my first tour, Frank basically said, look, don't worry about it, because, you know, remember last night when you mentioned the fact that back in the '50s, the '50s and stuff, when Frank was growing up,
yeah,
he was a WOP.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what Frank told me. He goes, no. Back when I turned, Frank said, well, when I turned 13 years old, I was 6 feet tall, had size 13 shoes, and I was a WOP. I was the nigger then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And he goes, so don't worry about it. I hired you. I'm the only guy that can fire you, and I hired you because I know you can do this job. So ignore it and don't worry about it.
Right.
You know,
it's not going to influence you.
I've got the confidence in you. So, and then that's very much an answer to what you were saying, because once he told me that I didn't give a damn anymore, you know, and I just went and did my job.
Good.
As long as Frank was happy and the audience loved it, everything was fine.
Okay. So in 200 Motels,
right. There's
this drama between Flo and Eddie and Frank, who's like not around, or he might be secretly taping him. Later,
right.
When
yes, exactly.
Okay, later, Flo and Eddie, in some interview, they said, "What we never understood is why Frank didn't hang out with the band." Now, this is the 70-71 period, before he get thrown off stage in London, and he says, "Why didn't he ever hang out with the band?" And then they kind of yell out, "Hey, Frank, when will you ever tell us why?" Take that aspect of Frank. What did you observe about that drama between Frank not hanging out with the band, or that's not true?
He didn't hang out a lot with the band. He hung out individually. You know what I'm saying? There'd be times when I'd come, you know, he'd call me, he'd give me a call and say, "Hey, come up to the room," you know, and we would talk, or me and him, or me and Vinny, or me and him and Denny,
right,
or you know, things like that. And he liked, basically it was more like, He preferred one-on-one. He preferred one-on-one.
Yeah.
You know, and basically, me too. You know what I'm saying? Because you can't really get to the heart of things, or really, communicate.
No, I know exactly.
With a room full of people. You know the drill.
Yeah, I know exactly. My mentor, Garrett Dean, in Nova Scotia, was this great guy. He said, "You come one night, Carolyn come another night. I prefer one-on-one. I don't want the cross vibrations," he says. The cross vibrations.
You know, in the studio, it's like crosstalk, right?
He meant cross vibrations when you have a bunch of people in the room, the vibrations between them. Doesn't mean angry cross. I don't mean that.
No. What I'm saying is, you know how it is in the recording studio.
Yeah.
When the mic picks up, instead of just the vocals, it starts picking up cymbals and other sounds and stuff like that. When you're trying to be discreet, when you're trying to get a discreet recording.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And musically, it's like that.
Right.
Musically, it's like that. It's crosstalk, but that's exactly true. That's exactly true.
And he wants every moment almost to be fruitful. He's working on so many projects as a scientist and all these things that if he's going to engage with somebody, he's going to give them the opportunity to contribute what he knows they can do it without other people sitting around saying, "Well, why not talk to me too, Frank?" That kind of stuff.
Exactly. And also, Frank was very, very interested in getting, each encounter being as productive as possible.
Yeah. Even just in having productive in the sense of having a good time and a number of jokes that come out of it. You know what I mean?
And not expecting any jokes or whatever. But because the best part about all of that is that's what makes it great.
Yeah.
Because when you go in with no expectations, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You go in with no expectations and just fresh and a pure, sincere, clean communication. That is when the true creativity and the results speak for themselves. Whenever the situation was like that, especially with me and Frank, for example, it would be the things that we would come up with, the times that we end up coming up with just all sorts of just silly stuff.
Yeah.
And our best stuff was those times when, like I said, Frank would call me at 2-3 in the morning and have me come up to the house or when at whatever time, and it would just be me and him and the engineer, or just me and him, and then we just start talking about anything.
Right.
And we'd discuss any subject, and after a while we'd
get a pattern. You'd get a pattern.
Our senses of humor, you know, we pretty much like laughed at the pretty much the same things, and we saw a lot of things the same way. And after laughing for about 20 minutes, then he'd go, "Hey, wait a minute, I got a great idea." Okay. And then I go into the vocal booth, and when I do this, and he'd pull out a reel of tape, and then he'd put it on and say, "Okay, look here. When I go to this passage here on the tape, when it gets to this section here," and I'd make my own little notes, and then jot it down.
Yeah.
And then we would just start doing stuff. That's how Joe's Garage, Thingfish, Hunch and Toot, all sorts of stuff. That's how we created that, most of that stuff. Actually, all of that stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And see, I like that approach. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's sincere. It's a more pure application of creativity. You know,
the overlapping of worlds, of each other's world. The overlap.
Well, sure. And without being derivative, and without being, let me say, without trying to do it.
Yeah. You'd laugh. Nothing would happen. Maybe for 2 hours. Then all of a sudden, you'd get something.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. It would take on a life of its own.
Okay. Right?
It would take on a life of its own.
Yeah. And actually, the pattern. See, for me, I kind of think up instant sociological patterns, so to speak, or group behavior.
Sure.
But what's interesting about Frank, that he gets patterns, it's musical sound patterns. That's what he gets, right?
Well, here's the phrase that Frank and I coined pretty much simultaneously. I told him that basically I viewed what we were doing because actually one night he asked me, at about 3-4 o'clock in the morning when we were working on Thingfish, he asked me, "Well, Ike, you know what? You know, your kids are babies right now. What are you going to tell them when they ask you, 'Daddy, what do you do for a living?'" and I said, "Well, I look at it as like, basically, I do live cartoons." And he goes, "Yeah, that pretty much hits the nail on the head." You know, it's live cartoons.
Yeah.
And that's what we do. That's what we do.
Do you know, there's a great interview with Zappa in summer of 69 for the L.A. Free Press. And I don't know if it was Art Kunkin, the editor of L.A. Free Press, who interviewed him. But the guy starts off the interview saying, "You know, your work," and this would be before Hot Rats comes out, right when he's breaking up the Mothers, August 69, after Woodstock, Manson's happened. He says, "You know, Frank, your stuff reminds me of R. Crumb's Zap comics."
Ha! Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Frank goes, "Yep." It's like he had no problem with that statement. Yep, that's right. Yep.
Great analogy. Yep. That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
That also, that's also pretty much in the ballpark.
Yeah. And look, he puts the covers of World for the Money are animated cartoon balloons. You know, he always.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. You bet.
And I wonder, did he make cartoons when he was in school? Did he acted out little skits in that for the kids, right?
He did art. He did art and stuff like that. A lot of people don't know about Frank's artwork.
Yeah.
You know, Frank used to do. He used to paint. He used to sketch. He used to do pastels and all that stuff. And yeah, there's a rumor that I get from his little sister Candy, who, like I told you, Candy Zappa,
yeah,
lives just like a mile away from us, that he used to do skits for her and make little cartoons and draw pictures for her and stuff like that. Yeah. Oh,
there,
yeah.
So, yeah, he's a painter, drawer, and a cartoonist when he's young.
You bet. I mean, I used to make my own – I used to draw my own comic books because my mom was an oil painter.
Right. Hey, before I forget it, your mother was a painter, an artist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was an artist.
Okay,
that's
so –
that's why my older brother is an architect and you know, I used to be the – in boarding school, I used to be my school's artist and stuff like that. I designed the school newspaper and things like that. You know.
What did your father do? What was his talent?
Ike won. He was just, you know, Mr. and Blue Collar. You know, worked four jobs a day.
Right.
But he was a singer. He was a chef. He was a medic in Korea. He was a MASH medic.
Yeah,
in Korea,
yeah.
when blacks weren't allowed to be in med school like that.
Right.
And Big Ike, you know, he's my hero, man. He's my hero.
And you're saying he's big physically?
Well, no, I mean he's like I'm taller than him, but he's like 5'9" and stuff like that. But
right.
He played semi-pro football. He was, you know, he's my guy. He's my hero, man.
Right. He was a good father to have as a role model. Is what
oh,
you're
you
saying?
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
You bet. He's my guy.
Okay, before I forget, did you ever see any novels that Frank read? Did he read novels?
He was into I think Burroughs.
Yeah, Burroughs, right? He read Burroughs in 78.
In fact, yeah, he knew Burroughs.
Yeah, cuz he did that the Nova convention in 78.
Exactly.
Right after Jonestown, and he read the asshole part or something.
Exactly, exactly. You know, no, he read stuff like that. But Frank read, he read everything, man.
Yeah, because he does say, there's an image, some people say he didn't read, and he'll say, depending on who he's talking to, he said, no, I don't read. It makes me sleepy, is what he said. But then somebody in 75 did an interview with him and found out and stated this, that Zappa read Thomas Pynchon. He read a lot more than his image did, allowed, or had up to that point.
No. Frank read everybody. He was extremely, extremely well read.
Now I know that Gail reads a lot, right?
I don't know. Now that I don't know.
Well, I heard her talk about it that she read a lot, and I'm just wondering, maybe she would recommend stuff to him that she had time to read.
That could very well be. That could very well be. I mean, I'm really not sure.
Yeah.
About that, so you can't. I mean, don't quote me on that because. That's you just telling me that just now is something new to me.
Right.
Okay, so but it would not surprise me.
Right. So Frank is reading, and there were novels around the studio, sitting around.
Oh God, yeah, there are books everywhere. It's like our house, you know. I've got novels and books and on science and murder mysteries and nonfiction and physics and geology and stuff. I mean, that's...
And fringe stuff, too, right? Fringe stuff.
Always. Well, it depends on what you see, one man's fringe is another man's...
Right.
Another man's classics. You understand?
Right,
so
right, right.
That's... I really don't... I try not to categorize it. It's like when it comes to my music or anything like that, I don't... People ask me, well, what kind of music do I write or what's my specialty? And I really couldn't tell you, you know, because I try not to categorize and pigeonhole
right.
anything.
But I guess by fringe, did you read books on the crop circles?
Of course.
Right. Okay. Now, and this will lead into our next session about you. You know, we've done Frank, other things might come up. But one thing I was just thinking of, when you're on the road with Frank and he would call you up to his hotel room, would there be a groupie or a woman around that would be listening
oh, God,
to that?
No.
Never would be.
Not while I was there. No.
Right. If he did have any things going on, they'd be done at other times. They would not. He would not allow a woman or a groupie to be observe his work with the musicians.
As far as I know, absolutely not.
Right. Now, is there
in any talk of that or anything like that? I was never a witness to any of it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the truth. I'd never seen anybody. So you know, which is weird because you know you hear about it all the time, but
yeah,
I'd never been personally a witness or an observer to any activity like that.
Okay.
Maybe I'm out of the loop. I don't know.
You're only good for intellectual stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
One last point was, was there other people that you know that he appreciated like he did with you, a one-on-one interaction?
Vinny, who else? Ruth. Let's see, who else? Duke, okay?
George
Duke.
Definitely
Duke. Yeah, because he loved George. He loved George. George was a great guy.
Yeah.
George was a great guy. And I actually, when we were working on Thingfish, and here's the last point because it's time for me to get off.
Right.
George, he reminded me, he goes, you know what? He reminded me or advised me, made me aware of the fact that I had, at that particular point in time, while we were doing Thingfish in October and November of 83, that he goes, I thought you might like to know, you just passed George Duke's record as the longest surviving member of my band.
Wow.
Congratulations. That's what he said. Okay? I had just beaten George's record at the time we did, we were working on Thingfish.
Wow.
And he congratulated me, gave me a big bear hug, and said, you know, I'm glad you made it this far. You know, it's like, I'll conclude with this. He said, you know what? You know, I really appreciate the fact that you stuck with me this long. You know, I know you might want to go in and pursue your world famous rock star career or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and like if you want to, you know, look, I don't mind if you want to move on and pursue your career and get famous like Vi and like Terry and Warren and all those other guys. You know, because I really appreciate it. And I told him, are you nuts? Look, let me tell you something, man. You're gonna have to drive me away. You're gonna have to drive me away from here, kicking and screaming, because I'm not going anywhere. Okay? But the thing is, Frank felt that a lot of those guys used him as a stepping stone to their careers, and I told him, I said, look, man, I could not pay money to get the kind of musical education that I've been getting here. You know,
and not only musical, you're an intellectual. All these other things he's doing.
Exactly. Not only musical, not just musical or whatever, but I told him, I said, nah, man, you're gonna have to just fire me. You're gonna have to just get rid of me because I could not learn anywhere else with this level, the kind of education that I'm getting from you. So nah, sorry about that. You know, you're not getting rid of me that easy.
And you still haven't left.
No, hell no. I still haven't left. Imagine that.
Yeah. What?
So that's that.
So Peter Arcigrosso, I think it is, they're going to do a book on you. What is the reason they would do a book on you, Ike?
It's not them doing a book on me. It's me agreeing to finally write my book.
And would that be about Frank or about a lot of other things too?
Well, it's about my experiences. It's about my experiences and Frank. You know, in other words, yes, Frank is involved in that and stuff like that. But it's not my life with Frank Zappa.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? And it's a different approach.
It's your story.
It's my story. And the thing is, my whole thing is not mentioned, in other words, bringing up Frank every 5 seconds.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Because people want to know, well, what's going on with Ike Willis? What's my take on it? You know, from my perspective, from my view, my thing with Frank. And the thing is, I'm not even going to really mention so much. I'm not going to be saying Frank,
right.
Frank, because really, I don't have to.
Right.
I don't have to. Because like I told you about this back in Germany last year, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When we were talking about this, it's like, basically the thing is, all right, so there I was. You know, so there we were, you know, and we were in Switzerland in 1980 and blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And the fans who know, I mean, I'm Ike Willis, so they already know who I'm discussing, okay?
Yeah.
All right. So that's how that works. That's how that works.
And
there's a
publisher who thinks there's a market and audience for your story.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's the thing. We did the research already, and yes, there's definitely an interest.
Okay, well, that's a good point to end on. We'll probably continue again soon. So. Let me end this by you can hang up. I'm going to do the disconnection myself here of the recording. Okay.
You got it. Thanks, Uncle Bob.
Okay. Talk to you later, Ike.
Thanks. Love you.
Yep. Bye.